with an eagle on top of it. It cut a stark contrast to the impressive municipal offices and other tall, well-manicured downtown buildings of this historic city, where in 1877, Brigham Young delivered his final sermon. Inside Bunderson's office was a reception area covered in green-striped wallpaper. Despite the less-than-ornate surroundings, Reggie immediately felt he could trust Mr. Bunderson. Reggie thought of him as a smaller man physically, in his late 50s, with a mustache, wearing a suit and tie. He had a quiet intensity, a bit of gravel in his voice. He seemed authoritative and smart. He asked Reggie the basic questions about what happened the morning of the accident, and Reggie replayed what he remembered, tearful, but not as emotional as when he'd met the therapist. When he faltered, his parents filled in the blanks. Reggie concluded by saying he thought the accident was caused by the wet roads. "I remember the weather that day," Mr. Bunderson concurred in the meeting. He said he wasn't surprised that something tragic could result from the rough conditions. He asked Reggie if he'd been on the phone during the accident, not just before it. "No," Reggie told him. Bunderson asked if he might get a copy of the phone bill, and Reggie's family said sure. Bunderson gave Reggie assurances and a few instructions. He told him he should not make contact with the families of Jim Ferfaro and Keith O'Dell. Even though Reggie hadn't done anything wrong, apologizing was admitting guilt. "Things should be fine, Reggie," Bunderson told him, and addressed the whole family. "I'll call you if I hear anything." Reggie felt some relief, reassured that jail wasn't imminent. And he felt he'd unburdened himself about the accident. As he looks back, he says, "I continued to believe what I was telling him was everything I knew and everything I remembered." On October 21st, a few weeks after the meeting, a 17-year-old named Michael Taylor Wick was driving south on Highway 91 in Cache County. His passenger was Christopher Lee Dorius, also 17. Both were football players at Skyview High School in Smithfield, the second-largest city in Cache County after Logan. It was 6:15 p.m. According to the highway patrol, Wick drifted off the road, overcorrected to get back onto the road, and was struck at high speed by a pickup coming the other direction. Both young men were killed on impact. The preliminary report could find no cause for this seemingly inexplicable accident. It just seemed like another teenage driving tragedy. "He's been part of the team for 4 years. A major part of the team," Skyview coach Craig Onder said of Wick. "It's just a shock." Eventually, there was a possible explanation. The local prosecutor's office was told that Wick was holding his phone at the time of the accident, but prosecutors didn't pursue the case because the two boys were already dead. Chapter 11. The Neuroscientists. In the 19th century, Helmholtz and Donders had begun trying to measure the capacities of the human brain. The next wave of pioneering brain scientists, a remarkable group of men and women, took their inspiration from World War II and the struggle of human operators to keep up with the staggeringly powerful machines and weapons of war. One of these pioneers was Ann Taylor, who was a little more than 5 years old when World War II started and the bombs rained down. She'd hear the piercing siren. Her mother or father would scoop her up along with her younger sister Janet and bring them down to the damp and musty cellar. They'd also take Tinkle, the family's tabby cat, and they'd wait. Sometimes they'd bring their pencils and scrap paper and draw to pass the time. As she got a bit older, still enduring the Luftwaffe's bombs, her drawings showed curious little doodles. They represented the Germans' deadly planes flying overhead. When the all-clear message would come over the loudspeakers, the family would ascend to the ground floor of their little house in Kent, England, midway between London and the Nazi airstrips in France. Her mother was a homemaker. Her dad was a chief education officer for the midway towns of Rochester, Gillingham, and Chatham. In the living room, there was a map on the wall with pins in it, and Anne's dad, Percy, would move the little flag pins to show what was happening at the front. Around Britain and across the world, war raged. It was a mechanized affair, men in planes and tanks or armed with guns, artillery, and advanced weapons, tore apart the bodies of millions of soldiers and civilians. At the same time, not unrelated, machines were being put to important scientific use. Researchers were trying to measure the ability of pilots and soldiers to sustain their focus while operating the advanced weaponry. How could pilots navigate these powerful planes, traveling at hundreds of miles an hour, while looking at the cockpit gauges, listening to the radio, evading anti-aircraft fire and dogfighting? How could soldiers on the ground, bombs falling all around, call in the right coordinates for airstrikes? How could the air traffic controllers keep track of the blips on the radar screen amid heavy fighting? People were looking at these screens, these very primitive displays, and looking for signals, like German planes coming overhead, and they often missed them, explains Alan Mackworth, a professor of computer science at the University of British Columbia, who also holds the title of Canada Research Chair in Computational Intelligence. Mackworth wasn't born until 1945, but he well knows the science from his own study, and because his father was smack in the middle of it. Norman Humphrey Mackworth, known as Mac, was working for the RAF, the British Air Force. They weren't doing theoretical work. They were trying to save lives by helping pilots and radar operators stay alert and capable in the face of an onslaught of information. "There was a huge crisis," says Alan. "If you misread the radar screen, got distracted, fell asleep, well, people died. Villages burned. Without being too hyperbolic, battles were won and lost, and wars, too. There was a young man, Donald Broadbent, who volunteered for the RAF at age 17. He would later go on to do some of the world's pioneering work in attention science, alongside the senior Mackworth. Broadbent's interests also stemmed from the war, and the basic day-to-day challenges he observed pilots facing as they tried to stay focused. The New World Encyclopedia quotes a former colleague of Broadbent's recounting an anecdote. The AT-6 planes had two identical levers under the seat, one to pull up the flaps and one to pull up the wheels. Donald told of the monotonous regularity with which his colleagues would pull the wrong lever while taking off and crash land an expensive aeroplane in the middle of a field. Paul Atchley, a professor of psychology at the University of Kansas, points to this collision course of man and machine during World War II as a central reason why scientists developed a new urgency around understanding the human brain. "We had these highly motivated individuals, radar operators and pilots, who would miss attacks or drop bombs on the wrong cities. Why did they fail? They were running up against the limits of their own brains. Technology was outstripping cognitive capacity," Dr. Atchley explains. "We could quantify the machine, but not the human. That's where cognitive neuroscience really started." For his part, Norman Mackworth had been born in India, the son of a British eye surgeon who performed cataract surgery for locals. The family then moved back to Britain, where Mac grew up in Aberdeen and became a scientist, a tinkerer, a great piano player, with a bit of a short attention span himself. He was prone to moving from concept to concept, but making big strides in a handful of key scientific camps. So, maybe, given his own impulse to jump around, it's not surprising that, during the war, he came up with the Mackworth clock. It was a black box with a point on it that turned in a circle. The point moved at regular intervals of a second, except that sometimes it would skip the 1 second interval and move after a 2 second interval. Such jumps happened at periodic, unpredictable times. It was the job of an experiment subject to press a button whenever there was a 2 second jump. Simple, right? After about 30 seconds, the subject's ability to focus, his signal detection, went down markedly. No wonder the radar operators, sitting 8 hours a day in front of screens, could miss these life-threatening blips, these German bombers that could kill their friends and family. But why? Unknown to little Ann Taylor, doodling to distract herself while her family tried to survive the bombs, defended by the RAF, this intersection of man and machine, the struggle to survive in wartime, was setting the stage for the next wave of attention study. What had begun with Helmholtz and Donders was taking a next major turn, and Ann, who later married and took the surname Treisman, was destined to be one of the researchers at the center of that stage. "Anne Treisman is brilliant," says Dr. Ghazali. "She was a pioneer." Dr. Ghazali sits at Mavericks, an upscale eatery serving American comfort food. The restaurant is a one-minute walk from the Gaz Loft, so close that Mavericks lets Dr. Ghazali and his girlfriend Joe take home the plates when they order out. They're regulars here, it goes without saying. And Dr. Ghazali, as much as he craves new experience and new stimulation, cannot help but always order the same thing, the southern fried chicken with the biscuit and greens. Dr. Ghazali is nothing if not a convincing figure. He sold 5 of the other 6 diners on the fried chicken. Patrick Martin, the big-time magician, is among them. He's got a thick build, short curly hair, wears a leather jacket, and seems to be a careful observer with a mischievous twinkle in his eye. He promises later in the night, maybe back at the Gaz Loft when First Friday starts, to show a trick or two, to demonstrate more about the power of attention and distraction. For now, Dr. Ghazali is talking a bit about how attention science unfolded and the leading researchers upon which modern work is built. What was so amazing about Dr. Treisman? "She was crucial in helping us understand bottom-up attention," says Dr. Ghazali. Anne's family survived the war intact. She performed well academically. So well, in fact, that she was among just a few students from her grammar school fortunate enough to get admitted into Cambridge and Oxford. Early in life, she'd expressed an interest in the sciences, but her father thought she'd have no culture, and so at Cambridge, she studied French literature. Her success earned her an offer for a graduate fellowship, but she thought spending 3 years studying a single medieval poet sounded restricting. She asked Cambridge whether she might pursue a degree in psychology, which was growing in prominence and credibility. They said in horror, "It's all about rats." And I said, "That might be interesting." Much of the focus in psychology at the time was around behaviorism. B.F. Skinner, John Watson, and others were focusing on the idea that human behavior could be understood by how people reacted to things. They put less focus on what was happening inside the brain, which seemed at the time like an inscrutable black box, the contents of which cannot be observed. Dr. Treisman was inspired to think differently by one of her instructors, Richard Gregory. He did all kinds of odd and even amusing experiments, like trying to show how vision could be impacted through neck strain, something he demonstrated by walking around the classroom wearing a heavy helmet to stress his neck muscles. Then he'd see how his vision changed. Could the physical environment change what was happening inside the head? The work was a distant echo of the work of Donders and Helmholtz, and the idea that brain activity could be measured. By now, Norman Mackworth was the first director of the Applied Psychology Unit at Cambridge. Working with him was Broadbent, who at 17 had observed pilot error in the RAF, and who was on his way to becoming a godfather of cognitive psychology. After the war, he studied auditory channels, trying to understand what we focus on and how much information we can absorb and process and under what circumstances. It was the precursor to the cocktail party effect, named by another British researcher, Edward Colin Cherry, in 1953. Another researcher, a Canadian named Donald Hebb, was exploring a different angle. He theorized that the organization of the central nervous system and neural networks were involved with and impacted attention. His name and work would become increasingly appreciated as neuroscientists delved beyond behavioral studies and looked at the physical structures of the brain. Hebb's seminal 1949 book, The Organization of Behavior, illuminated a new pathway for studying the anatomy of the brain's attention networks. These are among the seminal researchers in the field, but there were others, and collectively, with the war behind them, they had a new luxury. Gone was the immediate life-and-death pressure of figuring out how to help pilots and radar operators sustain attention under duress. And there wasn't really a thought that technology, in a general sense, could distract people on an everyday basis. After all, the daily dose of computers or telecommunications was still far away from most people. In 1945, for instance, AT&T began introducing a kind of mobile phone service derived from military radio technology in a few metropolitan markets in the United States. Far from being ubiquitous, it could only be used simultaneously by no more than 20 people in a single city. In 1950, about 9% of American homes had televisions. the first screen that would become a part of most people's lives. By 1962, 90% of households would have one. Researchers, absent the urgent need to know why radar operators fell asleep, started a new generation of more formal, deliberate experiments, trying to measure the capabilities of the human mind. Behavioral psychology was turning into the cognitive revolution, says Dr. Treisman. How does the brain process information? How much? And, she says, what kind of things overload the brain? In 1957, Treisman moved to Oxford to pursue a PhD. She posted a flyer around campus, asking students if they'd like to be subjects in a psychological experiment, and got plenty of takers. A subject would show up in a small room with a short wooden desk adorned simply with a Brinell Mark V two-channel tape recorder and a pair of headphones. The subject would don the headphones and discover that each channel was playing a different passage from a book, the same book, typically Lord Jim by Joseph Conrad. Dr. Treisman instructed the subject to listen to the passage coming into one ear, say the left ear, and then to immediately repeat what he or she heard. The trick was to ignore what was coming in on the right ear. Then Dr. Treisman added a twist. After the first 50 words or so of the recording, she switched the passages, such that what had been coming through the left ear was now coming through the right, and vice versa. About 6% of the time, as the subjects were repeating what they heard in the left ear, a word from the right ear, the unattended one, would slip through into their report. To Dr. Treisman, there were two basic conclusions. First, the attention filter is very effective, but second, our filter is not a total block. That was a relatively powerful discovery for the time. Broadbent, for one, had assumed the filter was total. He assumed people could focus on what they wanted and block out the rest. For all his contributions, Broadbent's assumption turned out to be simplistic in much the same way that, before Helmholtz, people thought reaction time was immediate, infinite. So what kind of things get through the filter? What interruptions and stimuli rise to the surface even when we're intent on focusing on something else? In a nearby office, a colleague of Dr. Treisman named Neville Moray made an interesting discovery also by experimenting with subjects hearing two different messages through headphones, known as the shadowing technique. He found that subjects listening to one message would, in only about 30% of cases, recognize that their own name had been said in the unattended ear, or be thrown off, derailed, by the sound of their name. Dr. Treisman herself made an indirect discovery about the kinds of things that pop to the surface, even when we're trying to ignore them. It happened by accident. At one point, she tried her experiment by playing passages not from Lord Jim, but from Dr. Zhivago by Boris Pasternak, the book that launched the epic film. One day, a subject started doing something Dr. Treisman had never seen before. He started remarking about the passages from Dr. Zhivago that were being read in both ears. It appeared on its face to be a highly unusual capacity to attend to both streams of information. It turns out that he was Pasternak's nephew, Dr. Treisman recalls, laughing. The subject professed great familiarity with his uncle's work. She surmised that even when we are trying to actively ignore something, we might be paying attention to it somewhere in the recesses. More monitoring may be going on than we realize, Dr. Treisman says. Even this reduced, unintended message will trigger recognition if the subject is important, relevant, or highly probable. Dr. Treisman's work verified the limits of the attention filter. It also provided a key building block in one of the most crucial emerging principles of the science of attention. There is a tension going on inside the brain. It's a tug-of-war between two different aspects of the attention system, one called bottom-up attention, and the other called top-down attention. Top-down attention is what we use to direct our focus, say, on a work project, or listening to Lord Jim through headphones, or when driving on the road. Top-down attention allows us to set our objectives and focus on them. Bottom-up attention is different. It is what allows our attention to be captured instantly, without our control, say, by the sound of our name, or a bird flying by, or the ring of the phone. Bottom-up attention operates unconsciously, automatically, driven by sensory stimulus and contextual cues. Top-down and bottom-up attentions are both essential to survival, and so is the balance between them. If we had no top-down attention, we couldn't direct our focus on important goals. But without bottom-up, we wouldn't be alerted to new stimuli, including danger. Imagine a caveman being so focused on building a fire that he never heard the lion coming through the bushes. Before Treisman and her peers, there was a sense that people could control the direction of their attention, even if their reaction times weren't instantaneous. What Dr. Treisman and her peers began to realize and define was a powerful clash going on inside the brain. Back at the Gaz Loft, another First Friday is about to begin, and so is Patrick the magician. He asks if he may borrow some money from the audience. A woman produces a $20 bill, which Patrick examines with approval, and just a hint of the magician's sense of drama. He stretches the bill, snaps it a couple of times, showing that it is, in fact, just a standard Andrew Jackson. Nothing fancy, no tricks. He stands beneath the tree that bisects the middle of the loft. Outside, neon light from the neighborhood leaks in from the big window. Some new music plays on Dr. Ghazali's many speakers. But for the five party-goers who are earliest to arrive, all eyes are on Patrick, specifically on his hands. With his right thumb and finger pinching the $20 bill, he reaches his left hand into his left pocket and pulls out a lighter. He holds the flame up to the bill. It seems to straighten a bit, get crispy, as he puts it, though it doesn't catch fire. He's making a gentle show of his openness. Just a lighter and a bill. Just an ordinary guy. He puts the lighter back in his pocket. He must assume all eyes are trying to watch for any sleight of hand. He shows the warmed-up bill to the woman who gave it to him. She approves of its ordinariness. Then he balances the bill on his fingers, then his palm, then on three fingers. And then he turns his hand upside down so that the bill sticks to his fingers even as they're pointed downward, seeming to defy the pull of gravity for it to drop to the ground. "This is not magic," Patrick says. "It's science." It's impossible not to think that he had some substance on his hands, some chemical that is causing the bill to stick. And then he takes both hands away from the $20 bill, and it appears to float in the air. There's a gasp or two from the small group. After a few seconds, Patrick blows on the bill and it floats to the ground, landing at the feet of the woman who initially handed it to him. He watches the audience look on in amazement. The woman leans down and picks up the money and shows everyone that, yes, it's just a plain old American 20, unaltered, not sticky. There's nothing that would seem to make this bill float in the air. Dr. Ghazali professes to be a little conflicted by what he's seen. Like others there, he wonders whether something magic has happened, but he also just marvels at Patrick's artistry. He's also seeing the trick through another lens, a scientific one. He says the trick suggests the fragility of our attention. Somehow, Patrick has mastered it without our awareness that he's done so. He's overtaken our top-down attention. He's got his audience thinking less and less about whether he's pulling a fast one and more about the marvelous thing they're about to see. He's transformed his goals into our goals. How will this drama end? But at the same time, he's perhaps toying with our bottom-up systems. Somehow. By simple movements, a look here, a redirection there, he plays to the reptilian parts of our brain that can't resist novelty, maybe important stimulation. Does a movement cause us to look away from a sleight of hand at just the right second? Does he prompt a laugh that makes it hard to focus on ferreting out the mystery? This demonstration set the stage for the next wave of attention science and the new discoveries as the 20th century wore on. "We're both interested in the same thing, but we're going at it in different ways," he tells Patrick. "We both want to understand how attention works. I'm trying to do it by looking inside the brain." The magic trick also hints at why technology plays so powerfully to our brains and our attention systems. In the latter half of the century, as technology moved from the military and corporate settings into our businesses and homes, the devices grew masterful at capturing our attention. It's not that they necessarily stole it from us or pulled a fast one, but the reasons we're so swept up, researchers began to understand, is because personal communications devices are unprecedented at capturing both our top-down and bottom-up attention systems, even without our awareness. They bring us stories like Patrick the Magician, engaging the top-down systems that want to find answers, complete tasks, follow narratives. They are the narrative of our lives, our work, our relationships. How will things turn out? How are we doing at work? How are things going with our spouse or partner or children? And the devices do it with lights and sounds that capture us beyond our ability to control. They buzz with incoming information, chime, change colors and images that call to us. This can reinforce our goals, alerting us to important information, but also capture our attention even when we don't want it to, even when it's dangerous, like when we're behind the wheel. Plus, Dr. Ghazali notes, the technology companies who build the magical gadgets have every incentive to make them our irresistible companions. Technology companies are trying to get more of our brains per unit time. It's as close to a business model as you can imagine. The more engaged you are in what they create, the more successful they are. They're driven to figure out how to engage us as immersively as possible, as deeply. At the beginning of the 21st century, scientists like Dr. Ghazali, following the footsteps laid down by 150 years of pioneers, are using technology to hone in on how our attention systems work, and they are doing so like their predecessors, in no small part, because they realize technology is putting heavy pressure on those systems, challenging the ability of its human creators to keep up. And there is another critical piece, and another key scientist. His name is Dr. David Strayer. He's a friend and collaborator of Dr. Ghazali. He's from Utah. And he has become the most prominent researcher to apply 150 years of attention science to a new question. How does all this technology impact the ability of drivers to focus when they're behind the wheel? Chapter 12. Reggie. In late October, Reggie took a job. It was at Murdoch Chevrolet, a dealership 2 minutes from his house. That's where the family had purchased the Chevy Tahoe Reggie had been driving the day of the accident, though he didn't think much of that fact. He'd gotten the position through his childhood baseball coach, Alan Williams, who worked as a salesman at the dealership. They had a position for a car detailer because one of the regular guys, Tyson, was about to leave on a mission. Even though it was winter, Reggie wore gym shorts and a ratty brown hooded sweatshirt. Tyson, the outgoing detailer and a former running back and football teammate of Reggie, explained the ropes. In a small garage on the dealership property, the detailers used little blue rags to make spotless the used or new cars and ready them for sale. Brushes, screwdrivers, and spray bottles hung on small hooks along the walls. They had an old blue power washer for the outside that was supposed to heat up the water, but it didn't. And it was unwieldy, like 200 pounds. And so the detailers couldn't really move it. It was always humid, the steam unable to escape from the small room. Moisture damage caused the tiles on the ceiling to erode or fall off. Even in the dead of winter, Reggie tried to keep the garage door cracked to let in cool, breathable air. But he wasn't really focused on his comfort. He was feeling deeply lost. If Tyson was there, the pair would talk. But when he left, Reggie would listen to the radio and totally zone out, sometimes drying the same spot for 5 minutes. Occasionally, he'd walk across the parking lot to Feldman's and Bear River Printing. It was owned and run by an older couple. Reggie and his friends would joke that you could go there and ask for a copy, and then wait 40 minutes for it. In the meantime, you'd order an ice cream and get so impatient watching the woman try to dig out a scoop for 10 minutes that you'd want to go behind the counter and help. These days, Reggie could also be just fine with sitting there, glazed over. His brain was lost on Valley View Road, prompting the inquiries of his state of mind. "Are you okay?" someone would ask, maybe Alan or one of the other detailers. "Of course. Stay busy," he told himself. "Eventually I'll work my way out of it." Keith's widow, Leila, returned to her bookkeeping job at Tech Electric, a local electrical contractor. The company had an insurance agent named Joe, and he'd heard about the accident and told Leila that she should consult with an attorney before accepting any insurance payment, just to make sure she was getting the best possible deal and not accepting anything less than she deserved. There was a big firm in town, relatively big, called Hilliard, Anderson, and Olson. The first principal, Lyle Hilliard, was a state senator. The third principal, Herm Olson, was known as one of the best criminal defense lawyers going. Leila called and got an appointment at the converted residence that the firm used for an office. Herm Olson, tall and thin with salt-and-pepper hair, sat across his desk and started listening to Leila's story. But not far into her recounting of the accident that killed Keith, Olson said, "I know all about it." "You do?" "The Shaws have already approached me to represent Reggie. Twice." The attorney explained that, shortly after the accident, he'd been approached by Reggie's parents, but he turned down the case. The parents made a second attempt to retain him, but he declined. Leila was confused. "I'm thinking, this is just an accident. Why is Reggie looking for an attorney? It was so incongruous." But she didn't think much more about it than that. Olson then listened patiently and told her there wasn't much to be done. A lawsuit probably wouldn't make much sense. Reggie didn't have a lot of money, and there wasn't any clear finding of fault. The lawyer suggested that Leila keep him appraised of anything happening in the case, such as it was. A few days later, Leila mustered the courage to return to the scene of the accident. It was a beautiful day, mid-morning. She pulled onto a side road, not far from the wreck site, that led to a gun range. Most of the accident debris had been cleared away, but signs of violence remained. Blue paint from Jim's car on a bent post on the right side of the road. Fragments of glass and taillights in the gully where the car came to rest. Skid marks. Leila, though somewhat in a daze, noticed something else. There was no shoulder on the road. No easy place for her to walk. No room for the cars to safely swerve. It seemed dangerous to her, even if she didn't quite put so fine a point on her observation. Just a passing thought. She started to sob. A man in a sedan pulled over. "Are you okay?"
"I'm fine."
She wasn't, of course. A few days later, on October 19th, she woke up vomiting. She was so weak she could barely get to the door to open it for her daughter, who took Leila to the emergency room at Cache Valley Specialty Hospital. It didn't seem like the flu or any obvious bug. It was grief. Leila was having trouble standing up. In the emergency room, they used an IV to give her 5 liters of saline. A week or so later, Jackie Ferfaro, Jim's widow, took her own symbolic, difficult step. She revived Moonrise, a night elf hunter. To do so meant going down to the basement and turning on one of the 2 personal computers, hers. The other of the pair belonged to Jim, and the couple often used them in tandem to play World of Warcraft together. Jim's chief character was Twinger, a gnome mage. Jackie favored Moonrise. In the game, even as they sat at different computers, they palled around, hanging out mostly together, going on virtual quests. Jackie had now returned alone, seeking comfort in the virtual world. Not long after Jackie logged on that night, she got a whisper, a message from another player. It was from Gary Maloney, an old friend of Jackie and Jim's from the Colorado School of Mines. He'd been Jim's best man. In the game that night, he was a human mage, a wizard. In the real world, he worked at a motorcycle repair shop in Indiana. He asked how Jackie was doing. Not great. But she wasn't telling people that. She was still grieving in her private moments, in the shower, late at night or in the morning. She was becoming resolute that Jim, who had such a zest for life, would have wanted her to forge ahead. That night in World of Warcraft, her natural first reaction was to ask how Gary was doing with Jim's death. Then, for whatever reason, she let down her guard a touch. "I'm feeling alone," she recalls writing to him. "I'm having a hard time doing it all." Gary wrote back, "You are not alone." A part of her, the engineer side, was still looking for some explanation. Was there anything Jim could have done to avoid the wreck? Could he have swerved? and adding to her irritation was the suggestion, the insane proposition, that somehow Jim had been at fault. That's an idea that came through to her a week or so earlier, when she'd gotten a visit from a local sheriff, Sergeant Tony Hudson. He was helping Trooper Rendlesbacher on the case. Jackie had called the sheriff's office because she needed a copy of the police report from the accident to process Jim's life insurance policy. "Of course, come by and pick it up," they'd said. But to get to the office meant she'd have to drive on Valley View Drive, and Jackie, as much as she was determined to move ahead with her life, wasn't ready to drive past the place where her first true love had taken his last breath. Sergeant Hudson was sympathetic and agreed to bring the accident report to Jackie's office at Utah State. As he handed the document to her, Hudson told Jackie that Reggie Shaw had lawyered up. And moreover, he said Reggie seemed to suggest that it might have been Jim who had been the one who crossed the yellow divider. Something was starting to smolder inside her. Why couldn't Reggie just call and say he was sorry? Chapter 13. Hunt for Justice. A local police detective named Mark Robinson lived in Rendlesbacher's neighborhood. A few days after the accident, he'd gotten a call from the trooper. "Hey, Mark, can I trouble you with a question?" "Sure, what's up?" "How do I subpoena cell phone records?" "I can help you, but it's a pain." "Why?" "I'm working a fatality. I think the driver who caused it was texting." "It can be done. It's not easy." Rendlesbacher's job was supposed to be finished at this point. When cases went a little cold, or were going to take time from a trooper's day job, they got passed along to a full-time investigator. In this case, the investigator was a guy named Stan Olson. According to a memo that Bunderson, Reggie's attorney, wrote to himself, Olson called him on October 25th. Bunderson confirmed he was representing Reggie and that his client would not be talking to law enforcement. The memo reads, "Olson seemed fine with that, but he did say that the trooper is really pushing the matter." Bunderson had asked the Shaws if Reggie was texting. Reggie had told his mother he wasn't on the phone. He seemed sure of that. That's what she told Bunderson. Per Bunderson's request, she got a copy of the phone bill. It was early November. The bill wasn't easy to parse. There were four phones attached to the account. As she read the bill, though, there didn't appear to be any records of the texts. The bill seemed only to include phone records. She took that as evidence that there hadn't been any texts. "This looks okay," she thought. "We didn't really question whether this was all of the bill," she says in retrospect. And, she adds, there wasn't much critical questioning of Reggie on her part. She gave the bill to Bunderson. He didn't note any problems with it. She was mollified, mostly. "You want to trust your kids," she says, looking back. Ed, on the other hand, couldn't stop worrying, though he didn't say it aloud. He kept waiting for another shoe to drop. He just knew it was out there. A few days before Thanksgiving, Rendlesbacher visited the stately Cache County Attorney's Office on Main Street. The trooper had come to see one of the seven county attorneys, a guy named Tony C. Baird. The trooper found Baird standing near the reception area, glancing at some paperwork. "Hey, Tony, can I chat with you for a second?" Baird led Rendlesbacher through the frosted glass door into his office. The pair stood and chatted beside two armchairs, beneath one of the dark wooden arches that are found throughout the grand building. Baird was about 5'7" and trim but muscular, the body of a fitness devotee, with short hair, a square jaw, almost preternaturally straight teeth. He had an all-American face that only slightly betrayed the man's competitive nature. An opposing counsel, or defendant, might be rightfully wary that Baird could be a tough foe if provoked. Baird wore his standard fare, a black suit and white shirt he got from a department store. It was a lot fancier than his father imagined, even hoped, that Baird would wear to work. Baird had been groomed to take over the family dairy farm, located in Lewiston, a small farming town on the border of Utah and Idaho. Dad threatened me with taking over the family farm, so I decided I'd try some of that college stuff, explains Baird. He went to Utah State. Then his dad tried to get him to come back to the farm. So I decided to try some of that law school stuff. After graduating from BYU Law School, he worked in several county attorney's offices in the state, spent years the Logan City prosecutor, and in 1997, he joined the Cache County office. By 2006, he was chief criminal deputy. Baird, who got up regularly at 4:30 a.m. to train for triathlons, could appreciate Trooper Rendlesbacher's tenacity. He had a bit of a reputation, Baird said. He'd heard that from Rendlesbacher himself. He kind of goes after people. But I wouldn't have characterized it as overzealous. That morning in late November, Rendlesbacher arrived with a common request. Court approval to further investigate the Shaw accident. Specifically, he wanted to subpoena Reggie's phone records. He briefed Baird on the case and added that he'd seen Reggie texting in the police car on the way to the hospital. Rendlesbacher said he thought Reggie was lying. Baird took it in. If the request for subpoena power was commonplace, the circumstances were not. Texting and driving? Sure, he'd heard a bit about it here or there, but never in the legal context. It wasn't something that had ever come across my desk. It wasn't something we'd ever looked at before, he says. He thought Rendlesbacher's focus on the issue was interesting, a word that almost seems to suggest that it was a bit of a wild goose chase. Baird wondered, is there even any law in the books that would allow us to pursue this case? His gut instinct was that this case wouldn't go anywhere. But Baird liked Rendlesbacher. And besides, the legal standard for getting the court to allow the subpoena wasn't particularly high. It was good cause, less than probable cause, a standard aimed at allowing the police to pursue the next level of investigation. Sure, Baird told Rendlesbacher. He asked the trooper to get together the affidavit facts to be submitted with the request to the court. Rendlesbacher was going to get his phone records, and, he hoped, his proof. Chapter 14. The Neuroscientists. As in so many other fields, the study of attention broadened and deepened as the 20th century sped along, and much of the gain owed to technology. Using emerging high-tech techniques, researchers pieced together the physical structures, down to the cellular level, involved with attention. Some of these developments were succinctly summarized in a book by Dr. Posner, the contemporary legend from the University of Oregon. In the 1970s, for instance, researchers used microelectrodes to hone in on a key part of the brain, called the parietal lobe, crucial to shifts in attention. In fact, as Dr. Posner would later help discover, patients with lesions to this part of the brain had more trouble shifting attention. Use of electrodes also allowed researchers to measure the time that it takes the brain to reallocate resources when attention shifts. Say someone saw a flash of light. About 100 milliseconds after the introduction of this new visual stimulation, the person showed changes at the neurological level. Measures like these added precision to the understanding of how long it takes the brain to react. Findings that were very much in the spirit of Helmholtz and mental chronometry, the study of the brain structures. In the ensuing years, better technology meant better imaging. Positron emission tomography, PET scans, MRIs, fMRIs, EEGs. The technology allowed researchers to examine finer slices of the neurological networks, their sums, and their parts. The network included parts of the brain like the anterior cingulate cortex, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, and crucially, the prefrontal cortex. These areas would show changes, like increases and decreases in blood flow, when study subjects were trying to focus on something, or when they were overwhelmed with information, putting intensified pressure on the attention networks. In Dr. Posner's book, Attention in a Social World, he writes that it is now possible to view attention much more concretely as an organ system, with its own functional anatomy. Scientists learn more about the capacities and limitations of vision, hearing, reaction time, the networks and parts of the brain most central to attention, and in turn to learning, and working memory, the short-term store of memory that people call upon as they maneuver through life. They broke attention down to component parts, or subnetworks, that are somewhat independent but not mutually exclusive. How you can control attention, how you sustain it, how you gather information and put it to use, how you inhibit interruption and keep out irrelevant information. And they began to understand the neural basis of the activity. At the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, researchers working largely with monkeys identified a powerful, multifunctional type of neuron in the prefrontal cortex. These executive control neurons, unlike many other specialized neurons in more primitive parts of the brain, a neuron in the visual cortex, for instance, might have the singular role of identifying the color red, seem to have the function of bringing together lots of information from disparate parts of the brain and organizing them, helping set direction, goal, and focus. At Princeton, researchers used imaging techniques in monkeys and humans to validate and further the understanding of what happens when the brain is asked to consider two different sources of information. When this happens, it appears to create a state of competition inside the brain. The source of visual stimulation that is most relevant to the person gets the lion's share of the neurological resources. At the same time, as more neurological resources are put to attending to this relevant information, there appears to be a decline in the neurological resources put toward attending to the less relevant information. That might sound obvious, but the implications are significant. The research gets close to answering a very crucial question, particularly for the digital era. When a person is paying attention to one thing, do they automatically ignore other things? Or is there a mechanism for allowing the person to modulate or control how much attention they pay to the other source of stimulation? A hypothesis born out of the Princeton work is that attention is a finite resource. Focusing on one source, a person, a mobile device, the road ahead of you, etc., comes at the cost of lost awareness of everything else. If that hypothesis holds, we face real challenges when we focus on a phone while driving. We can't just will ourselves to concentrate on both things because our brains are designed to put a huge emphasis on what we deem relevant information, to the point of suppressing brain activity devoted to something else. Despite this research, Dr. Ghazali believes this is a very open-ended question, and a crucial one. He thinks an argument can be made that the brain might be trained in its ability not just to attend, but even to multitask. That's another of the key emerging areas of science. Researchers explored the underlying mechanisms of focus. They also started to look at pushing the limits of attention. In other words, can the ability to focus, once more fully understood, be expanded? Is there a limit to how good we can get? Dr. Ghazali asked one sunny afternoon in the summer of 2013, sitting in his office at UCSF. Over his desk, a row of books. The Handbook of Aging and Cognition, Attention and Time, The Cognitive Neuroscience of Working Memory. Beside them, a small, kitschy, bronze-colored statue of a monkey looking at a brain. In the corner of the desk, behind one of his two monitors, a Buddha statue. On a whiteboard hanging next to his desk, scribbles of blue and red marker reflect a brainstorming meeting he had earlier in the day with a postdoctoral student working on experiments aimed at identifying the neurological basis for how people distribute their attention. Dr. Ghazali explained that people tend to be good at focusing and doing so narrowly, in a relatively small physical space, but when they seek to attend to a broader space, they lose detail. The experiments use video game technology to challenge people to distribute attention, then use imaging to measure brain activity during the task. Could they teach people to distribute attention more widely? Dr. Ghazali wore a black shirt and pants and black leather boots with a silver zipper up the side. A white 5 o'clock shadow crossed his face, and he looked tired but smiled. He said he had some good news. A study he'd been working on for 4 years could any day be accepted into Nature, perhaps the most prestigious journal in his field. The study explored whether specialized video games might be used to train older adults to do a better job at juggling two tasks at once, and might even help them become more focused over the long run. The study looked specifically at how older adults could be taught to improve attention using a driving simulator. "Getting into Nature for me is like winning an Emmy," he said. He hoped to know in a few days. It would be great attention for Dr. Ghazali's efforts, personal validation. It would also validate this emerging field of study. Indeed, even to be seriously considered by nature underscored the real-world applications of this new generation of neuroscience. The new body of work tied together the powerful new tools for looking inside the brain, with the seminal discoveries of people like Dr. Posner, with a line of science dating back to Broadbent and Treisman and their peers. Their work had focused on aviation. After all, airplane cockpits were the place where human beings were most acutely confronted with new technologies, powerful ones that taxed our neurological limitations. The cost of failure in the air was astronomical, in lives and dollars. From this rich tradition of aviation attention science, dating back to World War II, there grew a new field. It was the application of attention science to driving. One scientist in particular, David Strayer, played a pioneering role, though he faced great opposition when he first started his work. In 1989, Dr. Strayer earned a PhD in psychology from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He was developing a specialty in how people become experts and how they acquire skills and how those skills get compromised. How do they process information? How does information overwhelm them? The University of Illinois was one of the foremost places in the world to look at the interactions between humans and technology, an area of study known as human factors. The university had a reputation for spawning world-class scientists exploring how to optimize use of technology in airplanes and in the military, in the tradition of Broadbent and Dr. Treisman. The basic idea? How to make machines work best for people without becoming overwhelming. That's what Dr. Strayer figured he would do. In 1990, he went to work for GTE Laboratories. GTE was a telecommunications giant that did a lot of work in the consumer market, as well as for the government, including the military. And this was wartime. In January 1991, the United States entered the first Gulf War and was going after Saddam Hussein. As in prior wars, this one presented scientists with the challenge of helping soldiers and their commanders figure out how to take advantage of technology rather than be overwhelmed by it. But the technology issues were no longer just in the cockpit, affecting only pilots. They were everywhere. Communications tools and networks had become essential to success. Guys like Dr. Strayer were hired to figure out how to configure networks and displays so that the information was useful and life-preserving, not overwhelming and deadly. Strayer quickly realized that this work had widespread applications, and so, while at GTE, he started noodling a non-military question, one that troubled him and he couldn't shake. It had to do with the consumer side of GTE's business, the part that was making mobile phones and had begun marketing them for cars. Eventually, GTE would be acquired by Verizon, one of the biggest mobile phone providers in the world. To Dr. Strayer, the idea of using a phone in a car was troubling, at least based on now decades of science establishing the limitations faced by pilots when they tax their brains with too many visual inputs, sounds, and physical demands. He went to a supervisor at GTE and said, "Everything we know from aviation psychology indicates this is likely to be troublesome," referring to the idea of a car phone. "Before we start marketing this, we should think about it." Shortly thereafter, he heard from a supervisor that the company leadership wasn't particularly interested in pursuing the safety question. "Why would we want to know this?" Dr. Strayer was told. "That will not help us sell anything." Drivers were, arguably, the most important early market for mobile telecommunications. In fact, the first big commercial push for mobile phones were car phones. According to an article published in the New York Times, mobile phone companies, going back as far as the early 1980s, openly marketed the devices for use by drivers. One ad in 1984 asked, "Can your secretary take dictation at 55 miles per hour?" The mobile companies concentrated their cell phone sites along highways, hoping to capture business from bored motorists. They succeeded. A longtime telecommunications analyst named Kevin Rowe told the paper that 75% or more of wireless company revenue came from drivers well into the 1990s. "That was the business," he was quoted as saying in the Times. Wireless companies designed everything to keep people talking in their cars. Seeing these trends in the early 1990s, Dr. Strayer decided he was interested in getting answers, with or without his company's participation. He needed to be in a place where he could pursue answers. That turned out to be the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. He got an assistant professorship and started putting together experimental protocols, trying to borrow from the masters who'd come before him, Broadbent, Treisman, and on, essentially adapting the experiments that had been done for pilots to car drivers and car phones. There was nothing revelatory about such an application. It made sense. But on a societal level, the research was nothing short of profound. After all, scientists had been focused for so long on technology used by an elite class of people, not just pilots, but the soldiers and others who were privileged to have access to the supernatural devices. But now, the devices were becoming part of everyday life, or they were poised to become so. Cockpits in cars, Dr. Strayer thought. Perhaps it was not surprising that Dr. Strayer couldn't find a lot of funding for his research, given how many financial interests were arrayed in the other direction. So, he did his first experiment at the University of Utah by cobbling together about $30 in parts. He built a primitive driving simulator. In the experiment, the subject, an undergrad from the university, would sit in a chair holding a joystick, which controlled a car on a computer screen. The subject was told to do simple tasks. 1, follow along a curvy road, and 2, hit a button if a red light came on. That would break the car. At the same time, Dr. Strayer asked the subjects to talk on a cell phone. Some used a handheld phone, some hands-free with a headset. Separately, he also had the subjects drive while listening to the radio or a book on tape. There was a huge difference in the drivers' results, depending on what activity they were doing. When they were talking on a phone, they made twice the number of errors as when they were listening to the radio. The error rate was higher both when using a handheld and hands-free phone. Dr. Strayer says he was struck by the results. There's something about the phone conversation that's really kind of unique. In 2001, he presented his findings at an annual meeting of the Psychonomic Society. It was the very first study to show the effects of talking on a cell phone. The findings were very well received. Dr. Strayer had made an important connection between the past research in the attention distraction field and the challenges faced by multitasking drivers. "We made a link between this and 50 years of research on attention in aviation," he says. "The attentional limits we saw with pilots apply to drivers of cars. It was an important first step." At the time, though, Dr. Strayer thought it might be a last step too, a final statement. He didn't realize the pace at which mobile phones would be adopted and the extent to which they'd be used in all walks of life all the time. Plus, he said he couldn't find anyone to adequately fund the research. There was so much cultural momentum driving adoption and so many powerful business interests that no one really wanted to find out, or was interested in paying to find out, that the magical new technology had some side effects. And he was just beginning to understand something that would become much clearer as his research grew. The devices took a driver's mind off the road, even when hands were on the wheel and eyes were looking ahead. "If you asked at the time, I'd have said it's mainly a visual and manual demand. But it's a visual, manual, cognitive problem." In lots of science fields, the researchers get to know one another's work and often collaborate. That has happened in recent years around the field of attention, particularly the study of attention and its relationship to technology. There were more scientists going into related fields and more money. A new subspecialty was emerging as scientists grappled with the onslaught of new devices. Within this new ecosystem, Dr. Ghazali and Dr. Strayer crossed paths. The two had been invited to participate in a small one-day meeting at the campus of Stanford University in Palo Alto. The host was Clifford Nass, a sociologist who had been a math prodigy as a child in New Jersey and whose plan was to become a computer scientist. But Nass's life was changed by a fatal accident that took place in Utah when his brother, traveling across country, was killed by a drunk driver. The event devastated Nass and his family, and ultimately had him reevaluating his life choices. He wound up studying sociology at Princeton, and then becoming a professor at Stanford. In February 2011, he invited Strayer and Ghazali to join him, along with Anthony Wagner, a Stanford psychologist, Gary Small, a psychiatrist at UCLA, and Daphne Bavelier, a cognitive scientist at the University of Rochester. Each of them was gaining notoriety for understanding how heavy technology use, multitasking, impacted the brain. Nass wrote to the group, "My goal in inviting you is simply to bring together the people who are doing the most exciting research in multitasking." Dr. Strayer and Dr. Ghazali hit it off, even though they seemed cut from entirely different cloth, both figuratively with respect to personality and literally in terms of their sartorial choices. Dr. Ghazali favors sleek shades of black, and Dr. Strayer is more of a Levi's and t-shirt kind of guy. They decided to try to collaborate. Dr. Strayer would bring to the table his research into the behavior of drivers. Dr. Ghazali, a neurologist, would bring his understanding of neural networks and the technology that looked at the inner workings of the brain. "His techniques are bleeding edge," Dr. Strayer says of Dr. Ghazali. "We were able to take our leading-edge research in driver distraction and pair it with cutting-edge neuroscience." Dr. Strayer wanted the emerging field of research to also answer another question. Why, given it was becoming clear that the brain faced limitations, were people continuing to multitask, particularly in challenging, even dangerous situations? When he first started his work on distracted driving, he just assumed people would stop the behavior when they realized how dangerous it could be. But when phone use by drivers continued, even grew, he was forced to reach another conclusion, one that vexed him. People didn't stop using the technology because they couldn't. "I assumed people would come to their senses," he says. "It was naive on my part. Still, to this day, I'm surprised by how addictive and how alluring the technology is." The stage was set to incorporate the decades of past research and to marry behavioral science with neuroimaging to answer a new question. Why does interactive media do such an extraordinary job of capturing our attention? Chapter 15. Terrell. Late in the fall, Jackie Ferfaro drove her daughter Stephanie to gymnastics practice at Airbound, the gym on Main Street in Logan. It was just weeks after the accident, but Stephanie insisted on continuing to practice. Jackie